here, and I really appreciate the church and their gracious hospitality. It's been a really nice experience. So my name is Sheila Page, and I'm a DO from Texas, and I first got into this whole political battle years ago in Texas when I had started reading legislation trying to figure out how our state continued to pass laws that harm physicians in the practice of medicine in spite of the fact that we thought we had a lot of people on our side in the legislation. How did this happen? So I started reading legislation and looking at who are the people behind the scenes that are pushing these things. And I learned a lot, and it's really disappointing sometimes, but truth is always good to know. So what happened in 2013 in Texas was a bill was filed that was related to the treatment of patients at the end of life in the hospital. And it especially had a specific outline on how DNRs were to be assigned and whether or not treatment was be given or withheld. And it came to my attention because the medical association was pushing it and saying and sending out this email blast, you know, we got to pass this bill. And then I started seeing that there was a battle between the pro-life groups in the state. And that bothered me because, first of all, I didn't really have any association with any pro-life groups at that time. I was just on the medical side. Yes, I was pro-life, but I didn't really, honestly, it was kind of like I was shy of being one of them because, you know, they get a bad rap sometimes. So I noticed, though, that people who ought to be unified and ought to be believing in the same things and supporting the same things were starting to sling a little mud at each other. And that bothered me a lot. So I studied the bill, and I worked really hard on it, and I asked lots of questions from a lot of professionals, and ended up going down and testifying. And what happened there was even more surprising to me. It really was a wake-up call. About 75 people came from all over the state to testify, so the hearing went until like 3 in the morning. And people had come there to testify on both sides of the bill, either for or against. And there was a theme that was repeated over and over again, no matter what side they were on. Everybody was afraid that their physician in the hospital was going to kill them or their loved one when they were sick, or withdraw treatment and end their life early. And I thought that that should be taken very seriously by the medical profession, that now we have a broken trust with our patients, that so many people would come, you know, no matter what they thought about the bill, they all were thinking the same thing. If we don't do something, we're going to have our lives shortened by our doctors in the hospitals. So I'm going to try to explain to you some of the things that were in this bill and how it applies to the practice of medicine. And so I need to give you a little bit of background on the changing culture in medicine so that you have a better understanding of how some of these things could take place, even if it seems like it couldn't, because many people come still from smaller hospitals where the physicians are in charge of the medical care, and by and large, most physicians practice ethically, okay? But there are other forces now that play into the medical decision-making, and it changes how a physician thinks. So the first thing you need to know is your enemy. And as we've talked about in this conference, the enemy is that we struggle against is not flesh and blood, but the spiritual forces of darkness. And we know that the battle begins and ends in prayer. And that's really a hard thing to keep in mind when you've got people like this surrounding you. And these ladies were part of a huge mob that took over the Capitol grounds in Austin when we had a pro-life rally, and they were organized, they were persistent, relentless, and they were not playing nice. And their intention was to remove us, about 3,000 people, from the ground we were standing on. And they did. They did it very methodically and effectively. And that's why I say, when you're dealing with an enemy that has every intention to go to battle with you, and they're organized, and they're going to move you off whatever ground you're standing on. And we peacefully let them do that because we weren't going to respond in kind. This is a quote that I really like. It's Elizabeth Charles, and she was commenting on Martin Luther's confrontation of the key issues of his day. It is the truth which is assailed in any age which tests our fidelity. If I profess with the loudest voice and the clearest exposition every portion of the truth of God except precisely that little point which the world and the devil are at that moment attacking, I am not confessing Christ, however boldly I may be professing Christianity. Where the battle rages, the loyalty of the soldier is proved, and to be steady on all the battlefield besides is mere flight and disgrace to him if he flinches at that one point. Okay, so if you're going to engage in this kind of psychological warfare, which is really what we end up dealing with in politics, you need to know what their tactics are. And first of all, deception is absolutely the art of the game. And you have to come to that reality that they will do whatever it takes to get you under their thumb, and if it means lying to you, knowing exactly what you want to hear, they will tell you what you want to hear, and they will lie through their teeth, of course, to do it and get things moving their way. And it doesn't matter what they really intend to do. They will accuse, mock, isolate you, and their goal is to dehumanize you, and that's a Saul Alinsky tactic, and it was designed by Karl Marx. You never want to debate someone on the real issues and on ethics, because that makes them human. So they will never really engage in a discussion with you on the facts, okay? The facts are irrelevant to them. And so they will pick out leaders that are outspoken, and they will do their best to malign them and alienate them. Their goal is to make an outspoken leader look insane, if possible, to make them look like an angry person and an irrational person, so that even if you might agree with what they're saying, you're not going to align yourself with them. They're trying to separate you from anybody that you might influence if you're a leader. Again, facts are not important. They will stage participation, pretend to let you be involved and have discussions, but really they're gathering information and they're trying to figure out who they need to get isolated that's not on their side. They throw bones. Their favorite tool in politics is distraction. They're going to always make sure that you're running the other direction after some little easy thing that they threw at you so that they can do the real dirty work on the side. And then they use repetition of catchphrases over and over and over again so that it becomes reality to you because you've heard it so many times. And the one that I hear all the time now and I hear repeated by everybody that pertains to this talk is a complaint about how much money we spend on the end of a person's life. How many of you have heard that? What does that mean? We're complaining about how much money that we're spending on people when they're very, very sick. And the implication is, of course, oh, we're wasting so much money, we're trying too hard, we're doing ridiculous, futile treatments on patients that are dying. And that's not really true. You need to think about that, because our best efforts are made when we're trying to save life, and sometimes we fail. And so we may have spent a lot of money on a patient at the end of their life. So I want to kind of show you some of the messaging that was coming out from all the pro-life groups in relation to this bill that was filed and that everybody was fighting about. And by the way, it had passed the Senate and it was held up in the House. And that was the point of the battle, was that committee hearing in the House. So they had managed to convince some groups to be for the bill and some against it, okay? And so they put the pro-life groups against each other right away, and they were successful in doing this, and it bothers me a lot that they did that so well. So I was trying to figure out, how could this happen? Did they just completely deceive some of the leaders? Were the leaders intentionally misleading people and they knew what they were doing and they had been bought off? Or was the legislation so poorly written that it was confusing and anybody could interpret it any way they wanted? So here was one of the emails blasts that went out. Help families protect loved ones near the end of life. This bill has got to get passed, right? It never left committee. It's going to protect your loved ones from secret DNR orders, prevent secret DNR orders from being filed, and also, especially your non-terminally ill patients, protect them from having a DNR order signed without their consent. They were talking about food and water. That's a big deal. This bill is going to protect your loved one from having food and water withdrawn from them. And it requires doctors to treat all patients equally. That always sounds good, right? And preserve conscience protections so that physicians are not required to provide futile or harmful procedures indefinitely. I think that's an interesting statement, and that will play out in this bill. So here's another group. Don't let the Senate expand the Texas Death Panel Act. Emergency! The Texas Senate's about to expand the Texas Death Panels Act. So as you can see, there's a lot of emotion being kicked up here. Long on process, short on patient protections, unjust seizure of patient autonomy. This bill gives physicians and hospitals the power to dehydrate a patient to death based on subjective value judgments. One of the groups started putting out emails saying, we've got a coalition, we've got all these big players involved, they're behind the bill. And they used names, high-ranking church officials. They called them by name, they said they sent a letter, and they're accusing one group of providing misleading information. So just based on all of that, how could anybody really know what side to be on? It really is who's got your ear. And that's what happened. And it's really important. This was an email that was sent out by the Medical Association saying patients and families have autonomy, but, and of course they're talking to physicians, but they don't have an unlimited right to require the physician to do anything the patient or family requests. So they're supporting the bill and trying to push it on this from that light. And there's truth in that, right? Sometimes patients may want something that a physician knows is not in their best interest. Well, when that happens, traditionally, we as physicians, we talk to our patients, we explain things to them, we talk to the family, there's a discussion, there's interaction, and hopefully you know your physician at this point. And one of the biggest problems that we have now in healthcare is that separation of the family physician from the hospital practice, and the physician that you would that knows you the best is not always the one there in the hospital anymore. They hire hospitalists and palliative care doctors who really only see a snapshot of that patient. They don't know what you looked like yesterday. They see you sick and looking really bad, sometimes dying for that day. They don't know you, and they don't have the whole picture that your family doctor would have, and that puts you in a difficult situation. So again, you may be in a smaller hospital, smaller community, and you may not be experiencing this, But in the bigger hospitals in the big cities, we have tons of Medicare, Medicaid patients, and they're just trying to move people through and open up hospital beds for the next patient. This is a problem. So who should have the final say? Is it the patient's autonomy or the physician who says he knows best? And there are physicians that I have heard say, we know best. We're the ones that should say whether or not you should receive treatment. I think that's kind of hard to hear from a physician. I would much rather a physician have a discussion with the family and come to an agreement. And we recognize that there are times when there are families who have unethical goals and they've got a paycheck coming and they're going to try to drag out whatever they can out of, you know, mom or grandma in the hospital as long as they got one more check coming in the mail. And we've seen it happen. So that's part of the reason you get doctors on this other side. So I was talking about that element of trust, that the trust relationship between the physician and patient is essential. Without it, you really have a lot of potential for problems. And traditionally in the United States, we've always had the advantage of a private physician who knows the patient, and he's really accountable to the patient and nobody else. And they've known that patient for 20 years. And that's the best relationship that you can get. It's the best way to practice medicine, and you get your best outcomes that way. And somewhere in the middle, we now have a corporate practice of medicine that's developing in the United States. And it was always illegal before, but physicians are being hired by hospitals. More and more are leaving private practices because of the financial burdens that are put on them with regulatory demands, and now they have to answer to a boss first. Somebody who's not a physician, who doesn't know the patient, but who's watching the financial status of the hospital or the institution that they're in. And I really think that it's that environment where your physician may be perversely influenced by either financial concerns, because their pay might get docked if they make the wrong decision. Their reputation may be at stake, because if the hospital CEO doesn't like what they did, then they can report them to the medical board, which happens, and then their reputation gets ruined. There's a lot of things that can happen now, so the doctors are under more pressure to do what they're told and not necessarily listen to patients' needs. And this quote down here is from the book Nazi Doctors. I have not read it because it's a really hard book to read from what I understand, but someone sent me this quote and I think it says a lot, because when that trust factor is broken, psychologically speaking, nothing is darker or more menacing or harder to accept. And he's talking about physicians participating in mass murder. And I think that there's validity to that. There is something a little horrifying about someone that you had always trusted to save your life who now becomes the killer. So when we're reading legislation, we need to keep all of these things in mind. The changing culture of the medical profession, the coercive factors that can come into play, and who's behind this bill? What are their voting habits? Are they bad actors all the time, or are they people that are generally going to be promoting life and the value of life? Remember that once a law is passed, some agency is going to write rules, and that can entirely change everything. It can take a benign-sounding bill and make it horrific. You need to always compare the wording of the bill with the messaging that you're getting. And it can be difficult to read bills because they play a lot of mental games in the writing, and they'll twist things all around, and you have to refer back to previous sections over and over again, and it gets a little crazy. Look for deceptive wording that's intended to put you at ease, because I've seen it multiple times where the wording that you want to see is in there, but it's countered in a few paragraphs behind that. And so whatever you wanted to hear might be there, but it's completely overridden within the same bill. So keep that in mind, because that will happen, and they'll pull those sections out and read them to you and say, see, this is what it says. But it might not really be what the outcome's going to be. So I'm going to explain real quickly what a DNR is. And in Texas, we have a definition that doesn't apply in the hospital, but it's used in the hospital. And every state probably has a different application of the DNR. So I'm going to go by what we had and what we were looking at when we considered the legislation. So it's an out-of-hospital DNR in Texas. It's legally binding. It directs medical personnel in an out-of-hospital setting to not initiate or continue these treatments: CPR, advanced airway management, artificial ventilation, defibrillation, transcutaneous cardiac pacing, and other. There's your reference back to another section. You got to go back to that other section and figure out what the other is. It does not include authorization to withhold medical interventions or therapies considered necessary to provide comfort care or to alleviate pain or provide water or nutrition. So in this legislation that was filed, it set up a process of assigning a DNR in the hospital. So the first thing in the procedure was you give the patient a written notice of the hospital's policies. Who reads all of that when they've got pneumonia and they're very, very, very sick? Or if they're unconscious, is the family going to read the policy? I really doubt it. Some people might, but most people are not going to read that. So you got to do it by law. You get the policy. You have no idea what it says. Even if you did read it, you may not understand it. And then it states, this is the next step outlined in the legislation: before placing the DNR in a patient's medical record, the physician shall inform the patient or make a reasonably diligent effort to do so. What happened there? We went from giving them the policy, and now you're handing them a DNR. So there's a gap here that's filled by some process that's not described. And it could be the electronic medical record that spits out an automatic DNR as one of your default choices based on diagnoses or criteria that are outlined in the medical record. You really don't know what's going on that makes this decision, but I have a feeling that what they were thinking was that as we move to more and more kind of cattle mill type of treatment, there's going to be a process, and somebody's going to come along to every patient and make sure there's a DNR. And it may not be your physician, it may not be the person that knows you the best, okay? But that's going to be a requirement, because Medicare requires that, and the hospital gets paid based on what percentage of their patients have a DNR on the chart. And that, of course, would be related to criteria. So the next step was, okay, you get a policy that allows the notification to the patient to be given verbally. And then the DNR takes immediate effect. So you've been given a DNR, it takes immediate effect. You may or may not be able to interact with the physician at that point, so your family's got to do it. And then the next step is, if you don't like it, you can appeal in writing. So, it was a 40-page bill. This part right here, I would take that to my patient and say, how do you like this? And nobody liked it. Well, there's something just terribly wrong with all of this. And so, you appeal in writing, you got to go to an ethics committee now, and there's time being wasted. And we're talking about someone who's appealing for their life, and they didn't get a chance. So most physicians are not going to do this to their patients. I really believe that. I really do. But when we start to separate the physician and the patient, and the physician in the hospital does not know you, he's going to be more likely to make a decision, not because he's a bad guy. He didn't know you. And he didn't know you were, square dancing yesterday, and today you look like you're dying. So this is really important, and this is the sticking point where everybody immediately gravitated to. They saw this, they recognized the problems, and that was where the argument was. Now, that's in writing, But people were convinced that this was their protection. And I don't really know how that happened, but I couldn't see that. And so there were pro-life groups that were defending this because they didn't read it. They read the paragraphs that someone gave them saying, this bill is going to do this for you to support this bill. And that's why I think it's so important to read the legislation, as hard as it might be. Then I'm just going to run through a couple of these things. There were some exceptions that were put in there based on reasonable medical judgment. And I want to talk about reasonable medical judgment because that's an important term that I think that we need to consider. So on this exception, if death is imminent, based on reasonable medical judgment, then you don't really get your appeal, and they're not going to even talk to you about it. There's no time, is what they're saying. There's no time to contact anybody. Your death is imminent. It's over, and we're not going to deal with the DNR at this point. Somebody's making that decision. It's written into the law that we can make these decisions. And in reality, that might happen ethically. It could happen ethically, but it's when it's not done ethically that it's now allowed in the law. That's why you have to be careful about when things are written into law. There are conditions placed on whether or not you can consult your family doctor or the doctor that knows you the best. Maybe it's your specialist. And the condition placed on that consultation is whether or not he had a conversation with you and documented it in writing about your decision, about what you want to be done at the end of your life. Well, if you're 30 years old and you're unlikely to have had that decision with your doctor, but your doctor's known you for 15 years and you have an accident and you end up in the hospital, you know, he's cut out of the picture if he didn't have that conversation with you and document it. You see what I'm saying? Sometimes it looks like it might protect you, but in the end, it really unnecessarily carves out of the picture the person that you really want on your side. This is my friend, Beth. Beth was a fighter. She loved life. She had a cancer that was a lung cancer, and it had an unusual presentation. It showed up in her breast first, so there was a little bit of delay in initial treatment. So by the time that she got the right treatment, enough progress had taken place that it was aggressive and it was a very fierce battle for her. But Beth loved life. She fought every time. She would go into remission, improve, and have a big reduction of tumor and travel around and see all of her kids and all of her family. And she went to Africa. She was a missionary in Africa. And she would go back. And she just enjoyed every minute of her life, really didn't complain about having trouble breathing or having pain. And when she did, we knew she was in pain. Her oncologist knew her very well. He knew how she responded to treatment, and he knew she loved life, and he did everything possible to help her at the end of her life to continue treatment until it was obvious that there was no more treatment available that was going to help her. It would only harm her. And she was a beautiful picture of a person who fought the good fight. Her care was expensive. Her care was very expensive. And when she would end up in the hospital because the tumors grew, she was very sick looking, and she had that diagnosis, recurrent cancer. And if the doctor didn't know her, if she didn't see the doctor that knew her very well, they would look at her, tumor in her lung, and it's a very bad tumor, and see that she looks very sick at the time, and maybe not treat her, but rather put her on hospice. And there were multiple times when this could have happened, but it was because the doctor who knew her was seeing her that she continued to live as long as she did. So now, reasonable medical judgment. I just want to talk about that a little bit because I think it's so important. Reasonable medical judgment varies with the perspective and the training of the physician. What I might look at and think is an impossible case is nothing to an experienced oncologist or an internal medicine doctor who sees that all the time. That makes a huge difference. And so when we end up with a situation where we have people that are running a hospital that aren't your specialists anymore, but they're trained, maybe hospitalists, and I'm not saying anything bad about hospitalists or palliative care, but they're not the oncologist, they're not the cardiologist. They have a different perspective, and they only have that snapshot view of the patient. And in their reasonable medical judgment, they might say that you don't have a hope for life, but if they brought in the specialist, he might say, yes, you do. Let's do something. And so we need to be careful about how we understand that term and how we use that term, because it's so variable. And again, most doctors are very ethical, and they're not going to make unethical decisions. But as we start getting into more of treatment of the masses, and we're in a hurry, we're going to make decisions that we wouldn't before. And there's going to be a lot of pressure on people. In that bill, they were talking about irreversible non-terminal conditions and what would give you cause to withdraw treatment of that patient. And that might be a Down's patient or someone with diabetes or some other disease that's not terminal, but it's irreversible, or head injury. Okay, and so these are the criteria. Does the treatment threaten the patient's life? Would it exacerbate other medical problems? Would it result in substantial, irremediable physical pain? There's a lot of treatments that we do that, for a while, are painful. But is that comfort not outweighed by benefit? And would that treatment be medically ineffective in prolonging their life? So let me give you this case. This is a young 26-year-old man. He had a testicular mass that was removed by a urologist who didn't have him follow up with a medical oncologist after that. So what happened was, even though the tumor was removed, it metastasized and got way out of control. So 9 months later, he ends up showing up in the hospital with huge, huge tumors in his lungs that were pushing up on his diaphragm from the abdomen, because he had lymphadenopathy there, and the tumors in his lungs were putting pressure on all of his veins in his head, and they were getting distended, and he was in respiratory distress. His kidneys had failed. He had DVTs, thrombosis, blood clots in his legs, both sides, because of all the pressure of the tumors in his abdomen and his chest. I mean, He was in septic shock, and his blood pressure was 60 over 40. He was a dying man. He looked horrible. And that physician that first saw him thought, there's no way this guy's going to live. Absolutely no way he's going to live. But he called the oncologist, who came and saw him, and the oncologist came from out of town. It was a smaller hospital. And the oncologist said, look, I think we have a shot. This tumor is treatable. I know it looks bad, but this tumor is treatable. Let's try. So they transferred him to a bigger hospital, and they put him on everything. They did everything for him. So very expensive treatment for a man who really looked like he was dying. And the oncologist told his wife, look, we're going to do everything possible, but he might not make it through the night. This is a very serious case. Well, he recovered. He recovered rapidly and miraculously, really. And he's still alive today. This was 12, 15 years ago. He went on to have children, and he's raised his family. He volunteers in a children's cancer center, and he's living a good life. But it was because one doctor saw hope for life in him, and it could have been just as easy that, you know, another physician had looked at him and said, look, this is the end. So we need to be careful when we put value judgments on people's quality of life, because some people are willing to live with terrible disability, and they're very happy to be alive. And I've seen amazing cases, especially cancer ones, where people, you know, they can't swallow. They're carried around on a stretcher just about, you know. They're living their life, and if you ask them how they're doing, they're great. they're alive. And a lot of people would say, no way, I don't want to live like that, and don't do that to me, and that's fine. But that's a personal decision. You don't know how you're going to feel if that ever was your situation, and neither do I. And we have to be careful about placing those value judgments on people's quality. This is Peter Helms. This is the young man standing there next to his sister and with his family here. His father's a pastor, and his wife's and his mother is a good friend of mine. Peter, at 18 years old, was a basketball player. He played Rachmaninoff. He was a brilliant young man and very philosophical. People loved Peter, and Peter impressed all of his teachers. They wrote glowing letters about him when he was applying for scholarships for college. He got a full paid scholarship to the college of his choice, and he was just an outstanding young man, the pride of his family. And right after he graduated, he was in a car accident. He was hit broadside by another car that ran a stop sign. It caused a head injury that was a terrible head injury, and really the whole right side of his brain was damaged badly. It was badly damaged. But because of his age and his health, and everybody that was caring for him believed that there was a chance for his recovery, and they worked really hard to do it. And his family and extended family and the people in his community and his church all pitched in. They were all pulling for Peter. This was 6 years ago. And today, Peter cannot still swallow and eat food. He had a trach that was taken out. It had been put in the wrong place, so he had a horrible reconstruction surgery to repair the damage that had been done. He can't walk. He really can't communicate. He has a hard time even communicating by blinking. So, but you can tell that he enjoys the company of people around him, and he likes being with his family, and his family and friends love him. But if he were to become sick again with a pneumonia or something, and he ended up in the hospital, they would consider that a non-terminal illness, right? Irreversible illness. So would they look at his life as having value? They didn't know who he was before. They don't see who he is now except for his condition. They don't see Peter because he's changed on the outside so much. And so he would be someone that the medical profession might consider not worth saving. And that's a horrible thing to say, but that's what we're talking about when we say, why are we spending all this money on the end of someone's life? And I want to read you something that his mother wrote, because I thought it said a lot. She was talking about how when people would see Peter after his illness, after his injury, and the prolonged recovery, never really fully recovered the way we all hoped, they would say, well, that's not Peter. And she said, well, yeah, it is Peter. But it was hard on people, and I get it, you know. It's hard on us to see someone taken away from us like that. And she was saying, well, our cultural worldview has us focusing on the brain as the person. But from a Christian worldview, that brain is not who we are. We have an eternal soul. It's that eternal soul that defines us. And she said, the soul that we have is the essence of who we are. Our bodies are only our habitation, like a tent, while we live on this earth. So Peter's soul, who he is not changed. His brain is part of his tent. His brain is a tool that his soul uses. And the tool has been hurt. He's still the same Peter we've always known, and not any different. And she used this scripture, for we know it's 2 Corinthians 5. We know that if our earthly body house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, but eternal in the heavens. Anyway, I lean on that. I lean on her words, and because I need the courage, too, to keep on caring for Peter, knowing that he, you know, sometimes he doesn't know I'm there, and sometimes when I'm working with him, trying to make him feel better, he kind of reaches up his hand, he pushes me away. He's like, okay, I'm done with you today. You know, but he's interacting with me, and I just love him, and I love his life, and I think that it's a very difficult situation for family, and we all probably know other families dealing with the same or similar situations. So we need to keep in mind quality of life is an individual perception. And I'm going to give you another case real quick. This is an MS patient. She was wheelchair bound for a long time. She was 60 years old, okay? 60 years old with MS, wheelchair bound. And she was in remission from her breast cancer. So she had the diagnosis of MS and breast cancer. Well, she showed up in the hospital with a pleural effusion. She had fluid in her lungs that was building up. And it turned out that that effusion was because of a recurrence of the breast cancer. So she got the diagnosis on the chart as recurrent cancer and MS. Well, the palliative care physician that came in looked at her chart, looked at her, and thought, why would you want to keep living? Let's put you on hospice. So he talked to her about this, and she was signing the papers. She believed him because, you know, why wouldn't she? He's a physician, and he didn't, he wasn't a bad guy. He's not trying to do something evil. He's trying to help her. But they did consult an oncologist. They just didn't wait for him to show up. Well, when he came, he saw that she was signing these papers for hospice, and he said, wait, I haven't had a chance to see her yet. Let's stop before you do this and look at everything first. So he did, and he found out, well, that effusion, you know, is only in the lungs. It's very treatable. She has a chance to live, and she's not complaining about her quality of life. She has MS, she's wheelchair-bound, but she loves her life. So he treated her, and her cancer went back into remission for a while. She lived 4.5 years, and she had a reasonably good quality of life, and for her, it was 4.5 years of life that she wouldn't have had if she'd been put on hospice and started that process of dying. So I know we kind of started late, so I'm trying to watch our time. How much time do I have? Are we okay? Okay. Real quick, I want to go through this whole issue of the baby boomers because I hear it described as a problem that needs solving. It bothers me. We should be rejoicing that we have so many of our seniors around. And I love being with all of the people in my life. I'm gradually becoming one of them, right? We're all becoming one of them. So why do we keep hearing that this is a problem that needs to be solved? And well, it's all about dollars and who's going to pay for that? And it's, again, it just troubles me to hear this rhetoric repeated over and over again. And instead of valuing the people in our lives that give us wisdom and bring joy, and it's so much a part of that continuum of life that we love, we're talking about them as a problem. There's a lot of talk about signing these forms called POLST or MOST. They want people to sign ahead of time describing the treatment that they want to get or not get if they think they may have a year. So kind of stretching this out, can you guess what you might want in a year if you're feeling badly or if you're in a critical situation and you might be needing treatment? Do you want to be treated or not? And, you know, so Medicare is going to pay for that. And so now that's going to be a requirement in the hospital. Every family physician is going to have to fill these out. It's required. And if you don't do it, it's a demerit on your, you know, record if you don't fill these out. So back in 2014, you know, this was the rhetoric starts, and they're talking about, well, we need to pay for this time, pay for the physician's time to talk about care at the end of life. It's valuable time. I'm not saying it's not, but there starts to be a conflict of interest when you know that your physician is being paid to talk to you about this. And I think people sense that, and it seems disingenuous. So we kind of end up getting in this slippery slope situation. And this is Meemaw. Meemaw's 96 at this point. And she had a heart attack and goes to the hospital looking really bad, of course. She's 96. But she has done extraordinarily well. She picked cotton all her life, very healthy woman up to 96 until she had that heart attack. So most people would say, hey, she's 96. She's lived a good life. You know, let's let her go. It's time. But this doctor believed that she had life in her. He knew her. He knew that she was already healthy. So he put a stent in her. He saved her life. So she goes to rehab. She recovers very well. She sees her granddaughter married. She gets to see grandbabies, great-grandbabies. She lived to be 100. She got to celebrate her 100th birthday, and she died a few months later because one physician saw value in her and believed that it was worth saving her life. And believe me, her family loves her and loved having her those last 4 years. So if someone had given her a piece of paper at 95 and asked her, if you have a heart attack, do you want us to save your life? What do you think she would have said? So we need to think about these things. I think it's very important. Now we talk about rational suicide. I mean, you guys have heard some of these things about physician-assisted suicide. We're really starting to go down a direction where even in the medical journals, they're saying, look, the whole idea of physician-assisted suicide is just going to be standard of care. It's inevitable. And he writes that, inevitable. That's a slippery slope, right? We can't get off it. The medical profession is telling us we're going there. It's going to happen. You just might as well get used to it. Let me just close. C.S. Lewis, of all tyrannies, the tyranny exercised for the good of its victims is the most oppressive. And Ravi Zacharias said, if the murder of innocence is wrong, it's wrong not because science tells us it's wrong, because science can't tell us that that's wrong. It's wrong because every life has intrinsic worth, and we need to remember that. All right, thank you. So I think I've run out of time. I don't know who's monitoring the time, but I probably have used up all my time. Thank you guys for listening.
Thank you. What happened to that Senate Bill 303?
It died in committee. It did not pass. Yeah.
You're welcome.